From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, novelist David Levitt talks about the perils of writing autobiographical fiction and why he likes to reveal character through writing about sex. His new novel, Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing, is about writing and the publishing world as seen by a young gay writer and his famous writing teacher. Also today, we remember the celebrated Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai with a 1991 interview and reading. He died Friday in Jerusalem at the age of 76. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Clinton administration is pledging to lift economic sanctions against Yugoslavia if President Slobodan Milosevic agrees to step down in the face of an apparent defeat by the opposition. Milosevic supporters claim that the Yugoslav president actually won by a narrow margin, though not enough to avoid a runoff next month with challenger Vojislav Koštunica. Supporters say their election observers show the challenger winning by a decisive 55%. The leaders of Germany and Russia have added their support to what appears to be the opposition's victory, Owen Fay reports from Moscow.
German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder told a Kremlin press conference that the Russian government agrees with his assessment, that the people of Yugoslavia have opted for democratic change, and when the final votes are tallied, Vojislav Koštunica will emerge as Yugoslavia's new leader. Russian President Putin had no direct comment on the election, but did indicate he agreed with Schroeder's remarks. The comments were also mirrored by Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov, who said while there were some claims of voting irregularity, the election passed without major violations. Since the end of the bombing campaign against Yugoslavia last year, Russia has been Slobodan Milosevic's strongest international ally. In light of the comments today, he has now lost the support of the Kremlin as well. A final result from the balloting is expected sometime later this week. For NPR News, this is Owen Fay in Moscow.
The International Olympic Committee has stripped a Romanian gymnast of her gold medal after she tested positive for a drug. 16-year-old Andreea Raducan was found to have the banned drug ephedrine in her system. Raducan was given the drug and two cold medications by the Romanian team doctor. The doctor will be expelled from the Games and suspended through the next two Olympics. Speaking today in Santa Fe, President Clinton called on Congress to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act before it expires at the end of this week. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The Violence Against Women Act has strong bipartisan backing, but supporters fear it could get lost in the end-of-session rush as lawmakers try to complete their work so they can go home to campaign. The six-year-old law provides money to stop domestic violence and to help victims of abuse. So far, about $1.6 billion has been spent on shelters, a national hotline, enforcement of new penalties, and training for police, prosecutors, and judges. President Clinton said the problem of domestic violence is far from gone despite recent gains. He said about 900,000 women a year are victims. A spokeswoman for the House leadership said the bill was scheduled for a vote there this week. It also needs approval by the Senate. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials lost 39 points to close at 10,808 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Israeli and Palestinian leaders are meeting in Israel in an effort to restart the peace process. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat met face-to-face for the first time since the collapse of their Camp David summit last July. As they spoke, negotiators for the two sides prepared to come to the United States to begin a new round of talks. The annual meetings of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank begin tomorrow in Prague. Steve Beckner of Market News International reports.
The price of oil, which fell $5 per barrel last week, continued to soften after the Group of Seven Nations urged OPEC to do more to cut its price. Brent crude briefly fell below $30. Meanwhile, the single European currency, the euro, lost the gains it had made after the world's leading central banks cooperated to strengthen the embattled unit Friday. The euro was launched last year at $1.17 and had fallen to below 85 cents before the Federal Reserve joined the European Central Bank and others in pushing the euro as high as 90 cents before it fell back. The euro rose above 88 cents early today, but has since lost a full cent. This loss of purchasing power has compounded the cost of imported oil for Europe. The G7 has not been back in currency markets. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner in Prague.
Sales of existing houses rose sharply in August. The National Association of Realtors said sales of previously owned houses rose by 9.3% after falling sharply in July. The increase was more than twice what most analysts had been predicting, and it was the biggest increase in sales in 14 months. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost 62 points, or 1.6%, to close at 3741. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Levitt knows about the problems a writer can run into when his fiction is based on his life and friends and family feel their secrets have been betrayed. It's something the main character in Levitt's new novel learns, too. The novel is called Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. It's about a young writer trying to break into print while supporting himself at a publishing house where he's assigned to read through the slush pile. He's also trying to figure out how to come out of the closet. David Levitt's first book, Family Dancing, a collection of short stories, was published in 1984 when he was 23 and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Penn Faulkner Prize. Now with several books and a couple of major writing controversies under his belt, he's a professor guiding young writers. Levitt's new novel begins when the main character, Martin Bauman, is in college, taking Professor Stanley Flint's famous seminar, The Art of Writing Fiction. Flint is a professor who cultivates an aura of mystic authority. Here's a short reading.
Flint's seminar, to say the least, had a different rhythm. It worked like this. At the beginning of each session, a student would be asked to read aloud from his or her work. The student would then read one sentence. If Flint liked the sentence, the student would be allowed to continue. If he did not, however, and this was much more common, the student would be cut off, shut up, sent to the corner. A torrent of eloquence would follow, the ineffectuality of this slight undergraduate effort providing an occasion for Flint to hold forth dazzlingly and about anything at all. His most common complaint was that the sentence amounted to baby talk or throat clearing, this latter accusation almost invariably followed by the invocation, "Remember Flint's first principle," and from us, the responsorial chant, "Get on with it." Soon we understood that Flint loathed boyfriend stories, stories in which the protagonist was a writer, stories set in restaurants or cocktail lounges. To cocktail lounges, he showed a particular aversion. Any story set in a cocktail lounge would provoke from him a wail of lamentation, delivered in a voice both stentorian and grave, a sermonizer's voice, for the truth was, there was something deeply ministerial about Flint. Meanwhile, the student whose timid words had provoked this outpouring would have no choice but to sit and percolate, humiliated, occasionally letting out little gasps of self-defense, which Flint would immediately quash. An atmosphere of hyperventilation ensued. The windows steamed. Those Flint had maligned stared at him, choking on the sentences in which, a moment earlier, they had taken such pride, and which he was now shoving back down their throats. Yet when, on occasion, he did like a sentence, or even more rarely, when he allowed a student to move from the first sentence to the second, or from the second to the third, it was as if a window had been thrown open, emitting a breath of air into the churning humidity of that room, and yet a breath that would cool the face of the chosen student only, bathing him or her in the delightful breeze of laudation, while outside its influence the rest of us sweltered, wiping our noses, mopping our brows.
That's David Levitt reading from his new novel, Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. A lot of people figure that the teacher in this novel is based on Gordon Lish, the writer, editor, and teacher who was one of your teachers at Yale. Mm-hmm. Is he one of the models?
He's certainly part of the equation. Mm-hmm. But as I was working on the book, and I think this often happens with fiction, even if you start off with a real-life model, the character diverges from that model to the point that you start to forget what's real and what's made up.
Yeah. Well, assuming that you had someone, Gordon Lish or someone else in your life, who had, as you describe it, an aura of mystic authority,
Uh-huh.
I wonder what impact that had on you as, a young, growing writer. You know, I could see how you'd really become a praise junkie in a situation like that, where criticism was the equivalent of humiliation, because you weren't allowed to read any further if you didn't like the first sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And praise was, you know, elevated to, like, bowing before you in praise. I don't know. It could really turn you into a manic depressive or a praise junkie.
Well, I love that term, praise junkie. I've never heard that before, but I think it's perfect. The thing about me and to a great degree about Martin Bauman, who is sort of my alter ego in this book, is that I think I was a praise junkie long before I ever started taking writing classes. That was something that was really endemic to my character from very early on. But certainly the habit of being a praise junkie probably meant that I was particularly attracted to teachers of this sort, which I think a lot of people are, because a teacher like this really makes you feel that his or her praise means something. At the same time, I have to applaud the kind of teacher that Sandley Flynn is for instilling in his students an extremely high standard and making them feel that they're always striving to achieve that standard, and that once they've achieved it, the bar goes higher. So there's always something more to achieve. And I think that that's very healthy for a writer. When you become too complacent or too sure of yourself, it seems to me your writing usually suffers. Whereas if you're constantly trying to do something that you feel you can't do, your writing grows.
If you have the strength to withstand that kind of criticism, which not everybody mm-hmm. does. Did you?
Oh, yes. I'm pretty tough. I'm very thick-skinned when it comes to criticism. I mean, which doesn't mean that it doesn't.
How can you be so thick-skinned and a praise junkie at the same time?
Well, let's put it this way. I've always been a praise junkie, but I've become thick-skinned over the years because I've had to. Martin is not only a praise junkie, he's also avidly in love with the idea of being a writer, and he does have very high standards for himself, and he does want to be the best writer he can be. And that, in a funny way, militates against the praise junkie in him. There's a point in the book in which I talk about this, and I discuss about how the fact that in every writer there are really two beings. On the one hand, there's the artist who works in isolation, and on the other hand, there is the professional who is both his enabler but at the same time his enemy, because what the professional has to do goes against the very nature of what the writer has to do. And yet the two need each other, even though they're constantly in conflict.
How are they at odds?
They're at odds because writing is such a deeply private process. You sit alone in a room and create, and you dig things out of very private parts of yourself that in an ordinary situation you would never have to expose. Writing fiction is a process of self-excavation to a great degree. Well, then when you publish a book, you're suddenly taken out of the situation of an almost artificial privacy and thrust into exactly the opposite situation. You're suddenly in the public limelight. And even though you can tell yourself 1,000 times it isn't me, it's the book, at the same time, the book comes out of you. And so you naturally feel a very personal sense of identification with it. And that's something that's always fascinated me. Writers have to be, at the same time, the most private people in the world and the most public people in the world, especially living as we do in an age where in order to be a writer, you do need to do publicity. You do need
to
do
interviews like this.
Interviews.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this interview is a pleasure, believe me, compared to some. But when you think about it, those are very opposing impulses, and it's tricky to manage to be both those people at the same time, especially because there's something about the process of having to sell yourself, which every writer obviously has to do, that goes very much against the grain of writing from an artistic impulse.
I want to get back to the teacher in your novel, Stanley
yeah.
Flint. He's somebody who's full of, like, principles that young writers should follow and everything. And his second mm-hmm. principle is to perceive something one had gone through as particular or special was to commit not merely an error but a sin against art. He wanted writers to articulate the commonality that binds us all.
Yes.
Talk to us more about this principle and whether you agree with it or not, whether you think it's good advice.
Well, you know, I'm not really
given to having principles.
Well, no, I mean, I have principles, but I'm not very pronouncy.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
By comparison to Stanley Flint. However, I do think it is true, particularly in the age we're living in now, that writers need to remember that fiction is about making an experience accessible to someone who hasn't had it necessarily. And since we're living in an age where if you go into a bookstore, you'll see literature or fiction subdivided by all kinds of ethnic and sexual divisions. For example, the Borders I was in recently, where I found that my books were under gay and lesbian literature, but not under just literature. And then there was another section for black literature, and I noticed that Toni Morrison was there, but she wasn't under literature. When you're in a world which is so inclined to compartmentalize, I think it's very important to remember that the whole point of literature is to move beyond the particulars. The particulars are important, but so is the common ground that underlies them.
My guest is novelist David Levitt. His new novel is called Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. David Levitt is my guest, and his new novel is called Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. Another bit of criticism that the teacher in this novel passes on to the student, your alter ego, is this. And this is about a story that the teacher has read of the students. The trouble was it read like a public service announcement. Also, you write as if homosexuality itself was interesting. It's not interesting. All that's interesting is individual experience. What does the teacher mean here, and what do you think of the advice?
Good advice. Good advice. I would give it to a student. I think what the teacher means is that for fiction to come alive, for fiction to really mean something to a reader, it has to describe lived experience, lived human experience. And one of the problems, I think, with a lot of so-called gay fiction, particularly in the late 70s and early 80s, was that there lay behind it a kind of propagandistic impulse or a political impulse, the impulse being to somehow further a cause, to make the cause being or the purpose being to make the lives of homosexuals more publicly known, or to portray homosexual men, particularly in a more positive light, which is a noble idea, but one that runs completely contrary to the essence of fiction. Which, again, is always about individual experience. And when I look at my literary heroes and heroines, the writers I admire the most, what distinguishes them is the degree to which they seem to move beyond both genre and propaganda. If you look at a novel like Howard's End by Ann Forster, which is one of my favorite novels, there's a deeply political and somewhat subversive subtext to that novel that has to do with the destruction of a certain way of life by technology. And yet on another level, this is simply a story about the lives of human beings who interact and whose motives clash. And the novel works very well on both levels. You have to have both levels, though. Otherwise, you'll have what is more like a board game with the characters functioning as pieces in a kind of plot that has a moral or political purpose. And that's not fiction, that's propaganda.
Do you feel like you ever, particularly early in your career, wrote fiction that was more like a public service announcement than it was like good literature?
It's hard for me to say. Probably I would say no, to the degree that I'm able to judge my early work. I was more interested when I was younger in the idea of, for example, homosexuality as not only an integral part of someone's identity, but in some ways is necessarily the primary part of someone's identity. I'm less interested now in I guess I've been very influenced by reading recently a biography of Kinsey, and I'm more and more looking at sexuality as a very individual matter and thinking that it's much more interesting, if you're even going to write about human sexuality, to write about people one by one rather than assuming that all men who call themselves gay, for example, have an enormous amount in common, even sexually. They don't necessarily.
Well, this leads to something that your character says in your new novel. He says, "I've long believed that one can deduce more about a man's character from the attitudes he brings to sex than any other mode of interaction."
Mm-hmm. That is an observation that I've also long held. The sexual arena is one in which a lot of other aspects of our lives end up being played out. A friend of mine who's a psychiatrist once said to me, "Everything's about sex except sex, which is about aggression."
And I'm
not necessarily sure that I would sum it up quite so neatly, but I do think that sex is about all kinds of things other than sex, and that the way people interact sexually can be very revealing of the way of their character and other parts of their lives, other facets of their lives. You know, that's something that I do believe very strongly. What to me makes writing about sex valid and interesting is if sex is used as a sort of a vehicle to talk about a relationship or to talk about personalities rather than simply being presented for its own sake. And I think that is, for me, what distinguishes pornography from non-pornography, is if the motive is merely to excite as opposed to expose or reveal aspects of human character.
Do you have a favorite literary sex scene that you think is wonderful at really getting to character through sex?
Well, okay, I can think of two. In Lolita, the first time that Humbert makes love to Lolita after he's more or less kidnapped her and they're staying in that sort of dreadful country hotel, which is I wish I had the book in front of me because then I can describe it in more detail, but I think that that's a wonderful example of the way in which psychology is revealed magnificently through a description of what is basically a pretty unsuccessful sexual encounter. Another scene that I would mention would be in Alan Hollinghurst's novel, The Folding Star, a quite amazing scene in which the hero is watching through a pair of binoculars a sunbathing boy with whom he's besotted while simultaneously being made love to by a very lewd friend of his who is somehow aroused by the idea of having sex with him while he's longing for for someone else. I don't know how explicit I'm allowed to get.
Well, that's fine, but what does it say to you about the characters?
Well, I think it's a wonderful scene because it shows a lot about the way in which desire can be misdirected or directed in the fact that in a lot of sexual episodes, the desire isn't necessarily directed from one person to the other. And this is something that in this scene, the characters are willing to admit and actually revel in rather than fight against and hide.
Mm-hmm.
And in the example I gave from Lolita, there's no better example I can think of in literature of the degree to which all sorts of extra sexual factors end up being played out sexually. So much has preceded that scene in Lolita, the death of Lolita's mother, Humbert's Dolores Hayes' attempts to seduce Humbert, his percolating desire for Lolita. And yet when it finally comes to pass, when the act finally takes place, it's almost overburdened by how much it means. And it therefore collapses under the weight of meaning that Humbert has piled upon it. And I think that's beautifully, beautifully executed. And it's one of the reasons why Nabokov is probably, I would say in the long run, my favorite writer on sex.
The writer in your novel works for a publishing house, and his job is to read through the slush pile. And one of the editors there has a list on her bulletin board of sentences you shouldn't bother reading beyond, titles you shouldn't bother reading beyond, and words that you shouldn't bother being reading beyond. And the word that, you know, one of the words you shouldn't bother reading beyond is myriad. Now, I was thrilled that you chose this word, and let me explain why. When I was in a creative writing class in junior high school, I got into the class several weeks into the semester, and I thought, oh, God, everybody else in this class is so talented, and, you know, what do I know? And one of the students was reading a composition, and it had the word myriad. It even had the word plethora in it. And I didn't know what either of these words meant, and boy, was I impressed. And I was thinking, these guys are really creative. These guys can really write. And I've since come to think of those words as usually used in a real showy, pointless way.
Exactly.
They're real clunkers. So I'm just curious, of all the words in the world, why did you use myriad? Is that never use it kind of word?
I have to admit, I didn't know an editor who had a list like this, and the word was myriad, the word never to read beyond. And I was quite charmed by that because it did seem to me such a perfect choice. It's a quite, how else to put it, it's a pretentious word. It's a way of saying something simple and making it unnecessarily complex. And now that I say that, I suddenly fear that I may have done the same thing. But this is, I'll tell you, one of the humorous aspects of teaching is that you tell your students, never do this, never do this. And then if you happen to go on a book tour in the middle of the semester and you're reading aloud from your own book, you discover that you've done all the things you've been urging your students not to do.
Can you think of an example of that?
You know, we were talking about adverbs, and I said it's often unnecessary. The adverbs ought to be cut whenever possible because usually they weren't necessary. And the example I gave was he banged his fist angrily against the table. I said, you know, if he's banging his fist against the table, it's probably fairly clear to the reader that he's doing it angrily. You don't really need angrily. Well, I went to Atlanta last week and I was giving a reading for Martin Bauman. I didn't come upon that exact sentence, but I came upon the same kind of sentence. That is an instance in which there was an adverb that really was completely unnecessary. And I thought, oh, darn, why didn't I cut that out before I published the book?
David Levitt, his new novel is called Martin Bauman or A Sure Thing. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air, and from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of The Love They Lost, Living with the Legacy of Our Parents' Divorce by Stephanie Stahl. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, coming out, more with novelist David Levitt. He and the main character in his new novel came out to their parents at the same time they published a gay-themed short story. And we remember the Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai, who often wrote about war and love. He died Friday at the age of 76. We'll listen back to a 1991 interview. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with writer David Levitt. His new novel is called Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. It's about writing and publishing as seen through the eyes of a young gay writer and his celebrated writing teacher. Now, in your novel, your character publishes his first story in a magazine, and that first story is about him coming out to his parents. And he imagines himself saying to his parents, "Mom, Dad, guess what? I'm coming out in the magazine."
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first story you published in The New Yorker was a story about a gay character.
Yes.
Did your parents already know you were gay, or was that
part
of your coming out?
All that happened more or less exactly as it happens to Martin in the book. It was the sort of double whammy. And we were talking earlier about the idea of being a praise junkie. In some ways, I think I hoped to temper what I feared they would perceive as a piece of disappointing news by offering it in tandem with a piece of news that they couldn't help but be excited by, which was that I was publishing a story in The New Yorker. And that seemed to me a strategy that is probably very typical for young gay men and lesbians to try to achieve in order to compensate for what they fear will be a great disappointment to their parents.
Well, let me just point out about something about how you might have played your cards wrong here. Because you're basically saying, "Mom, Dad, I'm coming out. The good news is I'm getting published in the magazine. But the bad news is now the whole world is going to know." And it's probably like the last thing in the world they wanted the whole world to know while they were first absorbing it.
But in a funny way, that it was necessary for me at that point to tell the whole world and not merely to tell them. But you're right. I think it came as a real shock because it meant that something they might otherwise have boasted about to their friends became a lot more complex.
Yeah.
And this was all years ago. And now, you know, with my father, we laugh about this because it seems so much a part of the past. But at the time, it was, you know, a big deal.
So did they brag to friends that you were in The New Yorker, or was that something they tried not to talk about?
Well, actually, this is yet another instance in which the novel digresses from or diverges from reality. I had told them that I had a story coming out in The New Yorker long before I told them that I was gay. So they had already started boasting to their friends. Subsequently, I came home and told them what the story was about, and they had to sort of double back to compensate or to sort of alert their friends to what was going on. And yet I didn't, that didn't seem to me, this is an example of how sometimes reality just doesn't work in a novel. It can start, be the jumping off point for the novel, but it isn't necessarily the, the best way to handle something in a novel.
Oh, great. Now tell me why that wouldn't have worked in your novel and how you changed it in the novel.
Well, I'll tell you, I think it wouldn't have worked in the novel because even though it was true, I found it hard. I wasn't convinced that readers would be persuaded that Martin's mother would never have asked him what the story was about, which is what happened to me. I said, "Mom, I'm publishing a story in The New Yorker. My mother never asked me what the story was about." Now, if I tell you that really happened, you'll believe me, though you might, I would imagine, be surprised, because what mother isn't going to ask that question, I would think. And yet I felt that I couldn't get away with that in a novel because it strained credibility too much. And so I reconfigured it so that Martin wouldn't actually tell them that he was coming out until he had a story coming out in the magazine, until he also at the same moment told them that he was gay. The other reason I did that was because I wanted to end the chapter with the line, "Mom, Dad, I'm coming out in the magazine."
Now, did you expect when this happened to you that your mother would say, "What's it about?" and that would have been your opportunity to come out?
No, but that has to do with certain oddities of my family that don't translate onto the page very well. I was talking to my students about the fact that sometimes what is incredibly funny read aloud, or what's incredibly funny when you hear it as a stand-up comic routine, falls completely flat on the page. And by the same token, things that seem very funny on the page aren't funny at all when you read them aloud. And I think that's true, that principle can be extended to a lot of fiction. There are things that simply don't work on the page. And to get into the whole question of why my mother wouldn't have asked me what the story was about would have been, first of all, to introduce yet another complex element into a novel that was already growing rather complex. It would also have been to drag the novel away from what was its real central interest. And finally, it would have been to go into territory that simply wouldn't have been very interesting from a fictional standpoint or from a narrative standpoint.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think your mother didn't ask you?
Because I think my mother probably, on some level, guessed.
Ah, okay.
And didn't want to know.
Right.
But that would have, putting that into the novel, now that I think it would have involved a lot more speculation about her motives than I wanted to engage in this mm-hmm. case. I was trying very hard in this novel to steer clear whenever I could of the tactic of one character trying to guess another character's motives.
Right.
Because I wanted the novel, I wanted a different tone. I wanted this to be very much a recollection of an older Martin of an earlier period in his life.
My guest is David Levitt. His new novel is called Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer David Levitt. His new novel about a young writer and his writing professor is called Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. Anybody who, like you, writes fiction that is based somewhat on autobiography and on the experiences of people mm-hmm. who are close to you risks hurting or offending those people who are close to you, because they might read something that seems like it's based on something that really happened to them, and either they interpret the incident differently or they're insulted about the way you've characterized them, or they feel that you've betrayed a secret of theirs. How have you dealt with that as a writer? Has that been a problem for you?
I consider it an occupational hazard. And it's been a problem for me to some degree. And yet, I've got to say, in all honesty, I have been written about. I have been the subject of fiction. So I've stood on both sides of this fence. And it seems to me, especially when the people in question are also writers, it's very important to remember that no matter how upset we may be by what other people write about us, if we start yelling and screaming about it, we're threatening the very freedom on which our own creative lives depend. The other thing I want to say about this, which I think is really important, is that I think any serious writer is writing for the future, not for the present.
Mm-hmm.
And these kinds of issues are relevant only for a very short time. And it seemed to me that it would be a great artistic mistake to hold back on something for fear of hurting someone in the short run, which doesn't mean that you should go and write something that's sadistic or cruel, but I think you really will hurt yourself as a writer if you leave out some aspect of your own experience simply for the sake of not wanting to offend someone else who was part of that experience. And the thing to remember, of course, is that human experience, no one owns human experience. If you and I have a conversation, it belongs to both of us. And I think it belongs to both of us in an artistic sense as well, and we both have the right to write about it, which is why I would never, ever voice an objection to anyone writing anything about me, no matter how much I personally disliked it, no matter how much I was hurt or offended by it.
Well, have you been hurt or offended by things people have written about you?
Oh, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Many times.
Name something.
Fiction and journalism. Well, my an ex of mine wrote a short story about a character who was very clearly based on me that was published in an anthology a few years ago
mm-hmm.
that I was quite, I would say I was wounded by.
What was wounding about it?
What was wounding about it was that it seemed to me personally unjust. However, I realized that that was irrelevant to the story's value as literature. Whether I personally considered it unjust was a little bit like what, I mean, it ties into what Stanley Flint says at the end. Do you really think I'm, when he quotes Beethoven as saying, do you really think I'm worrying about your miserable fiddle when I compose? feelings of something being unjust, feeling of something being unfair, that's the miserable fiddle. And what matters is not the fiddle. What matters is the composition. And I will allow that, that story, no matter what I might have felt about it personally, has every right to exist and every right to remain in the arena of literature, because finally I was just the jumping off point for it.
Now, on a somewhat related note, you wrote a novel a few years ago that was inspired by a memoir by from the writer Stephen Spender, and he basically accused you of stealing his life for your book, and he sued you. Your books were pulled from the shelves until a new edition acknowledging the debt to his memoir was published. And I think I think you guys settled out of court, and then he died. Do I have the sequence
It was
right?
settled. Yeah, it was not settled for money. That the terms you just laid out were the settlement.
Though that you republish it.
Yeah.
With an acknowledgement of
and with his and book. With certain changes made. That was a very odd situation, because it was a case in which what the case was about legally was very different than what the case was about morally, as it were. Morally, it was really about his outrage at the use to which I had put this episode of his life. Legally, it was about whether he owned the rights to his own life. And you remember I said earlier that I think experience doesn't belong to anyone. Spender was effectively saying, this experience belongs to me. And what backed him up legally was the fact that he'd written a memoir in which he had recounted this episode from his life. Now, obviously, it wasn't the only source that recounted this episode. And obviously, the episode wasn't something he invented. It had actually happened, and it involved other people besides him. And yet, according to English copyright law, you actually can copyright a sequence of facts, which came as a complete shock to me, because it goes against most of the principles of American copyright law, and it certainly isn't something that seems to jibe very well with the First Amendment. But that was how it was legally. As I've thought about it in retrospect, though, I don't think the problem was that I was simply the fact that I used as the basis for my novel this episode from his life. I think the problem was that he didn't like the way I used this episode from his life. And so often that's the case. If the person in question approves, then you have no problem. If the person in question doesn't approve, then you have a problem. You know, you look at a book like Primary Colors, and that was a book which really only existed to tantalize people as to who was who. But it's probably a book that won't have much lasting interest historically, because as time goes by and more is learned about the Clintons and about the campaign, the interest of the book is going to naturally disappear. I'm trying to write, and I think any serious writer is trying to write, a book which, in which the opposite is the case, that as time goes on, people will become more and more interested in it because of what's inherently worthwhile about it. And yet, at the same time, I don't want to discount these issues. And one way in which I tried to acknowledge them is by actually having Martin have the very experience we talk about. He discovers towards the end of the book that he is a character in Stanley Flint's novel.
His teacher.
And his bewilderment and shock at finding out that he has been, in his own view, misportrayed, leads him to quite a lot of rumination on the very questions we've been talking about. What happens in the novel is that he discovers at a certain point that Flint lives more or less across the street from him, and he's never known this, which is entirely possible in New York, because so many people live in every building. You can live across the street from someone for 10 years without ever seeing the person. And he comes out early in the morning to watch Flint going to work and follows him once to the subway. Then Flint writes a novel in which his alter ego in his novel finds himself being stalked by a student whom he thinks may be in love with him. And Martin realizes that Flint has seen him and that he has given the episode a very odd spin in terms of his own interpretation of it.
Can you tell us what the incident was in the Spender memoir that you built your novel around?
Oh, yeah. Spender had a friend slash lover, it's still unclear, whose name was Tony Hindman. And at a certain point, he ended their relationship rather abruptly. It was a relationship in which there was a very wide gulf of class. Hindman was working class, Spender was upper class. And Tony, more or less in retaliation, went off to Spain to fight against Franco. Well, he got in over his head, and at a certain point, he tried to escape. He was arrested, and he was on the verge of being tried for desertion, and Spender went to Spain to try to help him and wasn't actually in the end very successful, and the whole thing sort of blew over. But it was that idea of a writer whose lover, after being spurned, goes off to fight in the Spanish Civil War and who then finds himself in a position of having to go and try to save him from the firing squad that became the inspiration for my novel. Although, again, it differed from Spender's experience in so many more ways than it resembled it. So I guess what I'm saying is I tried to... All the things we've been talking about, all these issues of, you know, of incorporating aspects of one's own life and other people's life into fiction, I've tried to make part of what this book is about.
Why at this point in your life did you want to get those issues into a novel?
You know, I've been thinking a lot over the last couple of years, and really since the Spender lawsuit, about the border territory between memoir and fiction. It was something that obviously was brought home to me when I found myself being sued by Spender because of the fact that this episode of his life that I used as the basis of my novel had also formed the basis of his memoir. That started me thinking about the difference between memoir and fiction. Around the same time, I started having a lot of conversations with Edmund White about his decision in novels like The Farewell Symphony to recreate his own life as a novel rather than simply writing a memoir. And his motive, he said, was that he didn't want to be hemmed in by reality. He wanted to be able to go off in whatever direction his imagination took him while using his own life as a kind of starting point. And then I wrote The Term Paper Artist, which is a novella about a writer named David Levitt who is being sued by an English poet and who in his despair strikes a deal with some undergraduates at UCLA to write term papers for them in exchange for sex. And once again, this was the beginning of a whole very important train of thought for me that had to do with the degree to which reality and imagination are separate. I mean, there are two completely contradictory commonplaces that people bat around about writing all the time. One is write about what you know, and the other is fiction is make-believe.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Very contradictory and kind of irreconcilable. But it was that was what I wanted to explore in the book. I'm really convinced that fiction comes down to contradictions, and that is one of the contradictions that's at the heart of this book.
Well, David Levitt, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure, as always.
David Levitt's new novel is called Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. Coming up, we remember the popular Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. He died Friday at the age of 76. This is Fresh Air. One of Israel's most popular poets, Yehuda Amichai, died Friday at the age of 76. He had lymphoma. Many of his poems were about war. His view of life was shaped by war. He fought in four of them, including Israel's War for Independence, the 1967 Six-Day War, and the 1973 Yom Kippur War. During World War II, he fought with the British Army in the Middle East. Amichai was born in Germany in 1924 and fled the Nazis with his family in 1936. They settled in Palestine. Poet Edward Hirsch said about Amichai, he had the rare ability to characterize the complex fate of the modern Israeli, the private individual inevitably affected by the public realm of war, politics, and religion. I spoke with Amichai in 1991 during the Gulf War, when Amichai and his fellow Israelis were wearing gas masks during Scud missile alerts. He had left his home in Jerusalem 5 days earlier for an American book tour. I asked him to read a poem from the book that had just been published, Even a Fist Was Once an Open Palm with Fingers. This poem is called What Did I Learn in the Wars?
What did I learn in the wars? What did I learn in the wars? To march in time, to swinging arms and legs, like pumps pumping an empty well. To march in a row and be alone in the middle. To dig into pillows, feather beds, the body of a beloved woman. And to yell Mama when she cannot hear. And to yell God when I don't believe in him. And even if I did believe in him, I wouldn't have told him about the war, as you don't tell a child about grown-ups' horrors. What else did I learn? I learned to reserve a path for retreat. In foreign lands, I rent a room in a hotel near the airport or railroad station. And even in wedding halls, always to watch the little door with the exit sign in red letters. A battle, too, begins like rhythmical drums for dancing and ends with a retreat at dawn. Forbidden love and battle, the two of them sometimes end like this. But above all, I learned the wisdom of camouflage, not to stand out, not to be recognized, not to be apart from what's around me, even not from my beloved. Let them think I'm a bush or a lamp, a tree, a shadow of a tree, a doubt, a shadow of a doubt, a living hedge, a dead stone, a house, a corner of a house. If I were a prophet, I would have dimmed the glow of the vision and darkened my face with black paper and covered the magic with nets. And when my time comes, I shall don the camouflage garb of my end, the white of clouds, and a lot of sky blue, and stars that have no end.
That's Yehuda Amichai reading his poem, What Did I Learn in the Wars? Now, I want to ask you about a line in that poem.
Yes.
The line is, to yell God when I don't believe in him.
Yes.
You know, there's an old saying that there aren't any atheists in a foxhole.
Is there a saying like this?
Yeah, right? There is. Yeah.
I feel like, as if I had said it. Yeah, it's exactly what I mean.
Yeah. Have you found in the wars that you fought in these conflicting feelings of not believing in God yet needing to believe in something?
I don't know if it's so much believing. I don't think it has to do with believing. It's just saying. It's just crying out something. So if someone says, you know, a lot of people who are believers and Orthodox, you always tell me, you see, if it comes to bad times, or even if you experience something very, very beautiful and good, you say, oh God, it was wonderful. So God is just a thing you say, because no one knows what it is and who it is. But it's something beyond. So instead of saying, oh, fate, or oh, supreme intelligence, and so on and so on, it's like I would... I called my father dad and my mother mommy, and it came to my mind to call my father dad. What's that? It's a name, it's a word. I never say, okay, it's a biological machine to produce me. Yes, so it's just a dad. So it's these things of childhood, and I think it's very great. It's a need to know that you can call something, even if you don't believe in it, and if the God imagined would be, it would be. Because Allah and God are the same, actually. Both Muslims and Jews and Christians believe in the same God. And yet each one prays to the same God to give victory to his arms. So it can't be, it must be something much more, which we'll never understand. And okay, because I'll never understand what it is, so why should I bother with it?
Excuse me for the stereotype, but I know a lot of writers feel that they're more comfortable reading or writing, you know, at a desk than doing very physical things like fighting in a war. And I wonder if through all the wars that you fought in, you felt like a very kind of physical t- type of person, or if you felt uncomfortable in that role.
I didn't start my life as a poet. I started writing only after two wars, but I was sensitive to it, and words probably were welling up in me, but I never thought of, you know, when I was in the army. I don't feel I am a poet. It's totally meaningless. It's not a profession. You are a poet when you write a poem. The moment you don't write a poem, you are not a poet. And to give you an example about the last few weeks in all these air raid shelters and so-called sealed rooms, a lot of people, of course, ask me, "No, have you written a poem about it?" You know, they always ask you, "Something's happening. Oh, write a poem about it." But I forget that I'm a poet. And I think poets who are constantly aware, it's in a very bad shape. People should be not aware constantly, "I'm a poet, so what do I have to say?" Yes.
In the introduction to one of your books, to a book of collected poems, the translator and editor, Hannah Block, tells about one of her friends describing how at the beginning of the 1973 war, the Yom Kippur War, her friends were going off to fight the war, and they were packing copies of your books of poems. And I wonder if you hear stories like that a lot.
I've cried a lot because my poems are out of experience, so whether it's a love poem or a poem about the death of my father or a poem about the war. So, because I wrote only about my own experience, so other people can use it. And I believe that every poem should always tell the truth, not say sweet things about situations we are not sweet, but on the other hand, not say everything is bad, everything is rotten, and death. So I think every poem, I wrote it for myself as a kind of healing or a kind of soothing song to keep myself going. And then eventually other people in similar situations can use my poems as a healing or to go on.
Yehuda Amichai recorded in 1991. He died in Jerusalem on Friday of lymphoma. He was 76. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shirok. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Expanded Quotable Einstein, available in bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
FX Tool started boxing in his late 40s and became a cut man, the corner man who stops the boxer's bleeding so he can fight another round. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tool about boxing and about his new collection of short stories, Rope Burns. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.